Is it infuriating to sit and wait for a length of cloth to be cut for her, or to have the needle in her sewing machine replaced? But she likes the work. There is a therapeutic rhythm to the rocking of the treadle beneath her feet, and a satisfying burn along her calves after she has been working the machine for several hours. She likes taking scraps and remnants and turning them into something useful, whether a table runner or a shirt sleeve. Anna isn't stupid. She knows that the staff at Dalldorf take the best work and sell it to vendors. She knows that they are profiting from her labor. She also knows that if she protested, they would say that no one is funding her stay at the asylum, and this is how she earns her keep. Worse, she knows that if she makes trouble, they will move her to another ward with less freedom. On still, quiet nights, Anna can hear the screaming from across the courtyard. She knows what happens in other parts of the asylum. If not having scissors is the price she pays for this relative freedom, then so be it. Anna suspects that the gauzy pieces of fabric she's sewing today are meant to be women's undergarments. Most likely slips. The material is a grey, raw silk, and it bunches beneath the needle if she works the treadle too fast. So she's bent over her machine, very carefully, rocking the paddle with her foot and feeding her fabric through the needle half an inch at a time. She doesn't see the nurse, the one she has nicknamed the duck, enter the workroom or stand beside her. Anna is so focused on the clatter of the machine that she doesn't hear her name spoken the first time.
Fräulein Unbekannt!
Anna jerks in surprise, and the pad of one finger is pulled beneath the pounding needle. When the needle is raised a second later, there is a smear of blood on the silk and another bright bead dripping down her thumb. Anna puts her thumb in her mouth and sucks, trying to numb the sting.
"Why did you yell at me?" she asks. "You didn't answer me."
"I didn't hear you."
"Come with me. You have visitors again."
It's been a week since the Baron left, and the bright thread of hope Anna felt after his visit has begun to fade. It flares to life again now, a white, hot undercurrent to her pulse. But she won't let the duck know, won't give her that advantage. Anna wraps the cuff of her shirt around her wounded thumb and carefully drops her hands to her lap. She lies.
"I don't want to see any more visitors."
The duck gives her an exaggerated bow and sweeps her arm toward the door.
"And yet you must."
Anna knows she's being mocked, but there is uncertainty in the nurse's voice. Nothing came of the events last week other than a general sense of unease sweeping across the ward. The staff stares at her now. So do the other patients. Anna doubts the duck or Dr. Arschloch believe her, but they aren't about to abuse her in any way either, not with émigrés sniffing about. Anna tidies her workstation slowly, forcing the duck to wait, enjoying the subtle noises of impatience behind her. Finally, she allows the duck to lead her out of the workroom and through the maze of narrow halls and into the tidy reception room. Baron von Kleist and Dr. Arschloch are waiting for them. The Baron is brimming with euphoria. Dr. Arschloch looks as though he's being asphyxiated. The Baron bows slightly and says,
"Tsarevna."
The two men continue whatever heated argument was interrupted by her entrance, and it takes Anna a moment to realize that her discharge papers are being discussed.
"You will get them ready immediately," the Baron says. "I am not leaving here without Anastasia." "I'm afraid it's not that simple."
"Of course it is. You said yourself that she is neither a criminal nor insane."
"I'm afraid there's some disagreement on that point."
"And that the only thing required for her immediate release was a statement declaring her identity and a written notice of my willingness to care for her upon discharge."
"Yes, however..."
"You will see that I have provided both in writing."
The Baron pulls two folded sheets of paper from a pocket inside his suit coat.
"And that they have been notarized by the local magistrate."
Dr. Arschloch's face is torn between competing expressions of fury and fear. He looks to Anna, trying to gauge her reaction, desperate to see if she will officially confirm this claim, terrified that she will. Anna smiles at the doctor, her face lighting up with every ounce of vindication she feels. She takes a step closer to the Baron, and this is all the consent he needs.
"Collect your things," the Baron says. "You're coming with me."
1 week earlier. Dahldorf Asylum, Berlin. May 21st, 1922. A woman has come to visit her, but she isn't alone. She's been escorted by a man so wealthy and so striking that Anna cannot help but stare. The woman is pretty, in the way all wealthy women are pretty, because of great care and attention to detail. She drips with the scent of expensive perfume. But the man smells of cedar and leather and fresh air. He's older than all the women in the room, late 40s, most likely, and the very sight of Anna brings a look of triumph to his face.
"See, I told you. The likeness is unmistakable. It's just as Clara said."
Anna says nothing, and this seems to unnerve him. He tilts slightly at the waist, a near bow, and says,
"My apologies. Of course you wouldn't recognize us. It's been so long."
He extends his hand, and Anna takes it cautiously.
"Baron Arthur von Kleist."
He tilts his head to the left.
"And this is my wife, Maria. We got here as quickly as we could."
This strange, well-heeled woman glares at the Baron. She does not reach for Anna's hand. She offers no greeting, but radiates uncertainty instead. If the duck had been interested in Anna's visitors before, she is dumbfounded now.
"I'm very glad to see you again," Anna says, and watches with great pleasure as the duck lifts one eyebrow in a high, curious arch.
Baron von Kleist offers such a bright grin that Anna cannot help but give him one of her own.
"No," Maria says suddenly, loudly. "It cannot be her. I do not believe it." "But it's obvious. Just look at her." "I have."
Maria shakes her head.
"She's too short to be Tatiana."
The woman gathers her purse and walks to the door without another word. The Baron, confused, moves to follow her.
"Wait,"
Anna says, taking a step toward him. He reaches for his wife and pulls her to a stop.
"How do you know Clara Poitert?"
"She is the daughter of a friend," the Baron says, "and she tells me you are the daughter of the Tsar."
"And you believe her?"
"I do now," he says, and then the two visitors are gone.
They have been alone for less than a minute, and Daldorf's head nurse is staggered.
"Who are you," the duck asks, "to get such a reaction from a man like that?"
The questions come quickly.
"Am I right in assuming those people believe you to be Tatiana?" She clears her throat. "Tatiana Romanoff?"
"Clearly not. You heard them."
"I heard her. The Baron believes something else entirely."
The duck is furious, in a pure, holy rage, as she rises from her chair and takes three cautious steps toward Anna. Her words are careful and measured, spiked with indignation when she asks her next question.
"Why did Clara Poitert tell them you were Tatiana? Why?"
"I did not say I was Tatiana. Not one time. Not to Clara, and not to them."
"Who are you, then? What is your name?"
"That," she points to the door,
"can never happen again. Do you understand?"
Anna has held on for so long. She has kept the truth of her identity wrapped tight against all prodding, pleading, and threats. It has been the one thing that no one could take from her. But sitting here before the window, bathed in a perfect rectangle of light, she is transfixed by a single name, the one name that can free her from this prison, all because of crazy Clara's aggressive reverence. Thanks to Clara, and to the Baron, there is the possibility of freedom now. All she has to do is speak. So she does.
"My name," she says, "is Anastasia Nikolaevna Romanoff."
1 week earlier.
Daldorf Asylum, Berlin, May 14th, 1922.
"Don't be a fool," Anna says. She wants to shake Clara, to rattle her teeth, but she doesn't.
Physical contact is prohibited between patients, and the scolding isn't worth spending her day in the small, dank room in the basement used for punishing rule-breakers.
"You're the only person in this whole godforsaken place who doesn't want to leave."
"But you are here."
"Oh, good grief, not this again.
You need me."
"No, I don't. I've gotten along just fine without you for many, many years. Go home, Clara. Your family misses you."
Clara's eyes are big and glassy on a good day, when she's happy. But at the moment they are huge grey pools that threaten to overflow. Anna hates it when Clara blubbers. Hates it for reasons she doesn't even understand. The poor girl can't help it. She's fragile and emotive. But Anna only sees weakness. Someone who is easily manipulated. Clara is the sort of woman who doesn't know how to think. Only what to think.
"What about your family?" Clara whispers.
Anna looks away. Whispers. "My family is gone." And then Clara is weeping into her shoulder, unconcerned about rules and policy or any threat of punishment. They've been allowed into the courtyard for a few glorious minutes, and Anna doesn't want the time to be cut short by Clara's hysterics. It rained earlier in the morning, but the sky is clear now and the air smells of warm grass and damp soil. Anna was enjoying herself immensely before Clara plopped down next to her on the bench and complained about being released. Anna shakes her off, afraid that the staff will see the outburst and blame it on her.
"Hush, enough. You'll get me in trouble."
"No," Clara shakes her head, determined. "I'm going to tell them who you are. That will fix everything."
Anna laughs. "You've been telling them for months."
"Not them."
She points to the duck and two orderlies who keep watch over the courtyard.
"Important people. On the outside."
Anna sighs. The chances of Clara knowing anyone important are as good as Anna waking up with brown eyes in the morning. But it won't hurt to let her try.
"That would be great. Very helpful."
She squeezes Anna's hand and drops her voice to a whisper.
"I promise. You'll see. I'll get you out of here."
The simple, foolish girl laughs, like they've shared some confidence. She pats Anna on the shoulder.
"It's okay. You don't have to pretend any more. Goodbye, Tsarevna."
7 months earlier. Daldorf Asylum, Berlin. October 3rd, 1921. One day Anna is consumed by silence and boredom, and then the next she is summoned twice by the duck to be inspected by strangers. From then on the visitors come in streams, one or two a day, sometimes three. Men and women who have misplaced a loved one and have seen Anna's photo in the paper. They hope against all reason that their daughter, sister, wife, or mother has been found. Every day Anna is ordered to dress and go sit in a small waiting room. Every day Anna sees hopeful, desperate, broken families, and every day she breaks them a little bit more. This is the worst of it for her, being an unwilling participant in their personal tragedies. The waiting room is deceptively warm, furnished with plush couches and framed by a large window overlooking the manicured lawn facing the entrance. It feels comfortable and calm, nothing like the stark, cold reality within the wards themselves. The room puts families at ease when they come to visit their loved ones, but like everything else at Daldorf, it makes Anna angry. Most of the visitors turn away immediately upon seeing her. They shake their heads, wipe their eyes and leave, muttering their apologies to the duck. Only one man has tried to claim her, and it was clear to everyone that he was crazier than any of the patients housed within these walls. The orderlies dragged him from the room after he lunged at Anna and tried to tear off her blouse. "My wife!" he screamed as they promptly removed him from the premises. "I want my wife back!" The duck had the decency to apologize for that one, at least.
They told me he seemed normal enough at the gate, she said afterward.
Pity you weren't at the gate yourself, Anna said, since you're so good at making judgments based on appearance.
Even after that, others come, only to be devastated to learn Anna is not the daughter who slipped out of an open window to meet her lover and never returned, or the wandering prodigal, or the straying wife, or the feeble-minded cousin. Day after day she remains unclaimed.
Fräulein Unbekannt, Miss Unknown.
She sits, yet again, in a chintz wing-backed chair beside the window, waiting for today's visitor. The fog has descended, shrouding the lawn and the long drive, so she doesn't see the black truck until it pulls up in front of the building. The man who emerges looks determined, even from this distance. But when he lifts his face to take in the enormity of the square brick building, she sees something else beneath the brim of his worn hat. A hardness along the jawline, an impatient gait as he slams the truck door and disappears beneath the awning. It's not long before she learns that he has come looking for his sister, some woman who wandered away from a boarding house in Berlin. The duck says that this man saw her picture in the paper and read how she had jumped from the bridge. This is the first Anna has heard of the newspapers publishing that detail. That's all she's told. But it's enough to put her on edge, and the duck notices the way she fidgets nervously with the hem of her dress while they wait.
"Do we have to keep doing this?" Anna asks.
"Has it occurred to you that I don't enjoy playing babysitter? That I have to stop what I'm doing every time someone shows up at that gate to speak with you? That I'm required to record the details of your time together? If you want to stop this, tell us your name. But if you're not willing to do that, shut up and quit complaining."
This is the harshest the duck has ever been with her, and Anna is taken aback.
"I'm sorry to be such a burden."
A sarcastic tone punctuates each syllable.
"Then stop being one."
Not that sorry, apparently, because she is sullen and uncooperative when the guards escort the man, slightly older than Anna, into the waiting room. He is considerably taller than she is, but they are similar in appearance, dark hair and blue eyes. The duck sits up a bit straighter to make a note of this in Anna's file.
"Felix Schanskowska," the guard says by way of introduction.
When it comes to poker faces, his is every bit as good as Anna's. He stares at her, head tipped slightly to the side, and gives no indication at all of what he's thinking. Anna doesn't break eye contact, but she does pick at her cuticles, one small show of nerves that she can't disguise.
"Why don't you introduce yourself to this young man?" the duck says. It's a test, and Anna won't fall for it.
She studies this Felix instead, and finds a very sad face regarding her in return. Unlike the others, he doesn't ask questions or try to touch her. He simply looks at her clothes, at her face, at her hands, her fingers, and raw cuticles. And for quite some time at the ragged scar that deforms her right temple. He seems to be reading her mood, her thoughts, the temperature in the room. She stares at him, defiant and quiet, willing him to leave. This exchange is so different from the others that the duck glances at them, back and forth repeatedly, scribbling notes on the page without looking down. Finally he curls his lip, then clenches his jaw, sighs.
"I do not recognize this woman."
And he's gone that quickly. Anna feels both triumphant and oddly bereft. She belongs to no one. "Can we stop this game now, please?" she asks. The duck closes her folder and tucks the pencil into the pocket of her shirt.
"Last I checked, Fräulein Unbekannt, you were the only one playing a game."
Chapter 26. Anastasia. Borrowed Time. 1918. Ipatiev House, Ekaterinburg, Russia. May 25th.
"How was your trip?" Father asks. We were quite worried about you.
We sit in a small room off the first floor kitchen, eating our usual dinner of chicken, roast potatoes, and fresh bread from a linen-clad table awash in candlelight. Even here, in this miserable outpost, we keep up the illusion of grandeur. Father drags a bit of bread around his plate, soaking up the chicken juices, and looks at me expectantly. I watch him pop it in his mouth and chew slowly while I struggle to find a suitable answer. Absolutely horrible, I say, finally, and Olga goes completely still beside me. Her fork is suspended halfway between her plate and her mouth. Her hand begins to tremble, and a piece of chicken wobbles off the tines and falls to the floor where Joy swoops it up greedily. Mother eyes Olga with suspicion. I can see my sister retreat into herself and shutter her eyes. So I shrug. I try to seem disinterested. The journey was cold and long, and we missed you terribly. Everyone relaxes then. Father nods compassionately, and my sisters each take another bite. Mother peers at me intently, however, not eating. I can feel that probing intuition stretch toward me, observing, measuring each of my words to guess at the truth. She always knows when I am lying. It's an innate sense that I do not understand, but learned to fear at an early age. And the guards? Mother asks. Did they treat you well? Olga and Tatiana push food around their plates, not looking up, hardly breathing. Maria, oblivious, slices a piece of chicken from the bone and eats it with the finely tuned manners of a princess. My brother gazes at a greasy spot on the floor where Joy licks gristle from the wooden planks. But my parents study me, and I know that my words will determine much of what happens next. So I roll my eyes and shake my head. Of course not. They were odious, as always. I don't know why they have to be so vulgar and uncivilized, so cruel. Sometimes I think that frightening us is their greatest entertainment. They wouldn't let us lock the door to our compartment, and they stood in the hallway all night, drinking and cursing and making those awful bawdy jokes. But we did our best to ignore them. I know that I'm rambling nervously, so I nod, as though to convince them of the veracity of my story. It is a gesture meant to convey our bravery and composure. I tear off a piece of the warm, crusty roll beside my plate and set it in my mouth, pretending that I don't have a care in the world. I chew the bread slowly, gathering myself to tell them what they want to hear. We didn't feel comfortable undressing for bed, so we slept in our clothes. I can't wait to have a bath and a good night's sleep. Didn't realize how tight Father's shoulders were until they drop in relief.
I'm sorry the trip was awful, he says, but I'm glad we're together again.
Mother takes a sip of water and smiles at me. There is something about the way her lips struggle to curl upward that makes me think she doesn't believe a word of what I've just said.
Where is Ortimo? She asks.
Tatiana shudders at the question, her body folding in on itself, her lips tremble, her eyes flood. And then she is gasping for air, racked by sobs. So I tell them how Semyon barged into the cabin, drunk, and threw Ortimo from the window. But I tell them nothing else. I cannot. Olga reaches for my hand beneath the table and squeezes it in gratitude. Father is enraged, but this news mollifies Mother somehow. She sits there, searching our faces, wanting to believe we suffered no other harm on the journey. I am sorry, Mother says, pulling Tatiana against her side.
I am so sorry about Ortimo. We will speak with Semyon. We will address this.
No,
Tatiana says, and then lower.
No, it won't change anything. Just keep him away from us. Keep all of them away from us.
He will not go near you again, Father growls.
Something occurs to me then. Where is Yakov? I haven't seen him since we arrived.
gone to Moscow,
Father says.
He does that occasionally.
Why?
He doesn't say.
Have you asked? Father sets his fork down on the edge of his plate. There is an angry slant to his mouth.
Yakov Yurovsky does not answer to me.
It is not like Father to be evasive, but I don't see much point in pushing him any harder in the middle of dinner. Father refills his glass from a crystal decanter on the table and drains it in four long gulps of water. It makes me sad to think that same decanter once held wine. Part of a serving set we use daily, it is now one of the few luxurious things we still have in our possession. When we arrived in Ekaterinburg hours earlier, we found that our living quarters were greatly diminished, even from what we'd had in Tobolsk. The room where we now eat, once a formal dining room for the previous owners, is expected to be dining room, parlour and study combined. The table is crammed in one corner with the chairs crowded together, and two couches are arranged along the other wall in an L shape. Some of Father's books are stacked in piles against the walls. The rest are stacked in crates in a back room, unopened since his arrival a month earlier. During the day, he uses the table as a desk. Dover has tried, with little success, to make the room comfortable by arranging rugs and hanging curtains, but the overall look is tattered and haphazard. Beyond that, we are granted use of the kitchen, a single bathroom, and three bedrooms to be split between us and our few remaining servants. My parents and Alexei share one, Botkin, Trup, Cook, and Dover are in another, and my sisters and I have been given the last. Our bedroom, as it turns out, hasn't been prepared for our arrival. So we make do, piling cushions and cloaks and spare blankets in the middle of the room. We peel off our clothing and throw it in the corner, relishing the feel of clean nightgowns and good hairbrushes. The baths will have to wait. We are too exhausted. Thomas and Ivan are somewhere on the grounds. I didn't miss the look of delight on Maria's face when she saw Ivan, but the bitter surge of jealousy took me by surprise. Maria is oblivious. She has no idea what happened on the train. Luck of the draw spared her from our fate, and there is now a distance between us that I do not know how to bridge. I doubt Olga and Tatiana will even try. We're in a strange city, in a borrowed home, and are still surrounded by countless soldiers. But our parents are here. We are as safe as we can be at the moment. It is true there are no locks on the doors, but Semyon will not dare touch us with our protectors nearby. He is a coward at heart, a greedy, loathsome opportunist, and we are utterly spent. So my sisters and I curl into that makeshift pallet in the middle of the room and give ourselves up to the great and merciful gift of sleep. Maria is the first to begin snoring, and when she does, I feel a hand reach out and brush my cheek. Then Tatiana's voice. "Thank you, Shripsik," she says. "I couldn't bear it if they knew." 2 days later. Ekaterinburg, Russia. May 27th. We enter the storeroom to find everything we own in shambles. Boxes emptied onto the floor, crates overturned, furniture broken. Clothing is strung about and books lay open, their spines cracked and pages mangled. All of our silver, crystal and fine china has been stolen. Sold, no doubt, to some second-hand store in the city. The trunk containing our corsets was taken to our room immediately upon arrival. Otherwise, it would have certainly been pillaged as well. Dr. Botkin and I have come to retrieve our camp beds so we won't have to sleep on the floor again. Many of the items that travelled with our parents, and almost everything we brought from Tobolsk, is stored in this large, empty room at the back of the house. In hindsight, it's obvious that the soldiers have unrestricted access to this room, but we had no way of knowing that our belongings were being pilfered. It is one thing to have everything you own picked through and winnowed down. It is something else to see it trampled on and torn to pieces, pillaged,
violated, ravaged. I have never been one to hold my anger, but I lose all pretense of control upon finding this mess. Anastasia, Botkin warns, don't. But it's too late. I'm already picking up my skirts and running. Because the truth is, my anger has nothing to do with our belongings and everything to do with the rage I have held, bottled and corked since that night on the train. I find Semyon outside, beside the fence, surrounded by a group of men. Their heads are thrown back and their throats filled with the coarse sort of laughter that makes my stomach churn. I know what they're talking about, why they're laughing, and I am driven forward in fury. There's a momentary flash of uncertainty on Semyon's face when he sees me storming across the grass, arms pumping and face red. For a second, it looks like fear. He hides it quickly, however, and by the time I reach him, his true emotions are masked with that ever-present sneer. You, I say, breathless, as Botkin trots up behind me. Semyon rests one foot against the fence and crosses his arms over his chest. Yes. You let your men go through our things. You let them steal from us. I didn't let them do any such thing, he says. I ordered them to. Soldiers draw closer from all across the yard, curious about the commotion. In my peripheral vision, I see Thomas and Ivan shift from their posts at the front door, rifles slung over their shoulders, and wander close enough to hear. You have no right! Botkin's hand settles heavily on my shoulder. Challenging Semyon like this is foolhardy, stupid even. I've seen firsthand how merciless he can be. Yet the dam has burst, and all that pent-up rage comes spilling out. I have every right. You are not royalty. You are not even citizens. You are prisoners, and your belongings are property of the state. Be thankful we left anything at all. Yakov ordered me to sell the valuables. I could have burned the rest. Semyon pushes off the wall and eyes me curiously, as though he has only now noticed my existence. He looks me over slowly, the way he does with Olga, and I force myself not to shrink back when he reaches out and fingers the collar of my blouse. I could have sold your clothing, you know. I could have left you all naked. My spit is dripping from his eyelashes before I realize what I've done. The hand that was playing with my collar a moment earlier grips me tighter. He yanks me forward, inches from his face, while he wipes the spit from his eye with his other hand. He is a good bit taller than I am, but I roll up onto the balls of my feet, unwilling to back down. I can feel Botkin's long fingers digging into my shoulders as he tries to pull me back. And I can see Thomas in the edge of my vision slide the rifle from his shoulder. He holds it loosely before him, ready to aim. Semyon shakes me once, hard enough that my head snaps backward and pain shoots through the base of my skull. You should be more careful with the things you value, or they will be taken from you. He raises his hand and brushes it along my cheek, tucking my hair behind my ear. Then he plucks the diamond stud from my earlobe and holds it up to the light. It looks enormous there, pinched between his fingertips, like a button. Semyon tucks it in his shirt pocket and yanks the stud from my other ear as well. Don't bother me again, you stupid little girl. You have no rights. Botkin steadies me when Semyon pushes me backward. I can do nothing but retreat, and I hate myself for it. My only consolation is the look of pure hatred on Thomas's face as he glares at Semyon. He has returned to his post at the door by the time we pass through, but he has not repositioned his rifle. It still hangs loosely in his hand, finger hovering over the trigger. Thomas catches my eye just as I shake my head. I hope he understands my meaning. Don't do it. Not yet. 1 week later. Ekaterinburg, Russia. June 5th. No one ever tells you that time grinds to a halt when you are in captivity, that each day becomes a year and each week becomes a lifetime, that you will live a dozen slow lifetimes over the course of a single month.
I thought that life was hard when we were put under house arrest at the Alexander Palace. We couldn't travel or visit with friends. We had only the palace and the grounds at our disposal. And then we went to Tobolsk, and our lives narrowed even further. A house, much smaller, and a meager yard defined our existence. But we had many of our things, and a good rapport with the guards. We did not understand how lucky we were in either place until the reality of Ekaterinburg began to settle in. Now we have only a handful of rooms and a small weedy garden that we are allowed to visit for 30 minutes twice a day. Our lives shrink to a pinprick of what they were before. With June comes the heat, and since Semyon will not let us open the windows, oppression soon follows. We make fans out of ruined books. I chose War and Peace because, masterpiece though it is, I've never gotten through it without skimming entire sections. I console myself that I am finally able to appreciate Tolstoy's penchant for philosophy. How can I not? It is waved in front of my face for hours every day.
We can only know that we know nothing, and that is the highest degree of human wisdom.
Those words are burned upon my grey matter. I dream of them pouring from the heavily mustachioed mouth of Pierre Gilliard, Mr. Philosophy himself.
Nothing is so necessary for a young man as the society of clever women.
Thomas whispers these words to me in my dreams, and I curl into them, begging him to say them over and over.
If everyone fought for their own convictions, there would be no war.
Father. We are asleep until we fall in love. Maria, cooing this into Ivan's ear as he dangles upside down from a tree while eating one of my pears. This part, I admit, is odd, but dreams are not meant to be rational. Everything depends on upbringing. Mother, sternly shaking her finger at me as I pick willow sap from my hair.
One must be cunning and wicked in this world.
Semyon congratulating himself as he straightens the front of his trousers. Even in my dreams, I am nauseous and enraged. On and on these dreams go, tumbling over one another, voices and messages mingling together until I wake one morning, shaken, my hairline damp and my breath ragged. It is that early, nebulous hour before dawn, when the sky can't make up its mind what colour it wants to be, and you don't know whether it is today, tomorrow, or perhaps yesterday. As the last vestiges of sleep drain away, I roll over, looking for my sisters, a new alarming habit I've developed, a headcount of sorts, but find only two. Maria is gone, and I am gripped by a flash of panic. I dress quickly and shut the door quietly behind me, hoping that I haven't woken Olga and Tatiana. They sleep uneasily these days, tossing and turning, crying out in the darkness, and I don't want to rob them of precious slumber. I find Maria in an alcove beneath the stairs, wrapped in the arms of Ivan Skorokhodov. I've never seen such kissing. Certainly not from my parents, nor in the paintings we've studied. This is something else. Primal and hungry. Frantic. Ivan has one hand in her hair and the other on her bodice, his thumb caressing the rounded underside of her breast. I stare at the motion he makes with that one finger, circular and tender, and it takes a moment to realize that Maria is still in her nightgown. Only a thin layer of fabric separates her skin from his hand. I gasp, and they pull apart as though they've been touched with a branding iron. Ivan takes one look at me and flees. Maria, on the other hand, cannot decide on an emotion. Anger, fear, embarrassment, stubbornness, euphoria, all of these things flash across her face before she says, "Please don't tell Mother and Father. They'll be furious." I want to threaten her, to say that I will tell our parents everything. But it would be a lie. "You're going to get caught." "Not if you don't tell." "It will happen eventually," I say. "And what then? Aren't things bad enough for us already?" "He loves me." Maria's voice turns tremulous and weepy. "He's the only good thing I have right now. And he's going to help us get out of here.
I need him. We need him. Don't be a fool. That boy can't help us.
He's not a boy, and you don't know that.
Go back to bed, I tell her, before someone finds you here.
Maria pushes out her jaw, stubbornness winning the battle of emotions.
You've already found me.
And you should be thankful that it was me and not Semyon.
So you won't tell?
It is stupid not to. Maria needs to have some sense shaken into her. But what does it matter anyway? Why rob her of the one thing that gives her hope? I would want her to keep the secret for me if the situation were reversed. If Thomas...
No, I suppose not,
I say, banishing the thought altogether.
But this is the second time I've found the two of you together. You're being sloppy.
Thank you, she whispers and plants a kiss on my cheek before tiptoeing back to our bedroom. 2 weeks later. Ekaterinburg, Russia. June 18th. My 17th birthday comes and goes without celebration. Cook bakes a pastry, and my family toasts me at dinner, but it is nothing like the vacations and parties we used to enjoy. I wasn't expecting much, yet I am still sad. I lay awake, feeling sorry for myself long after my sisters begin to snore. I listen to the sounds of this strange new house, the creaks and groanings, the footsteps upstairs as the soldiers walk back and forth, water in the pipes, the occasional burst of laughter in the yard, the protest of the stairs as someone steps on the loose board halfway up, the gentle, feminine breathing of my sisters, now deep in the recesses of sleep. I press my face into my pillow and chide myself for wanting more than I can have and missing what I cannot get back. I've worked myself into a good, frothing cry when the door handle to our room rattles gently and then turns. The lights are off across the house, so when the door creaks open, all I see is more darkness. I reach instinctively for the boot beside my bed and remember that it is empty. The paper knife is gone. I am defenseless. Jimmy stirs at my feet. The sound draws the intruder's attention, and those careful, quiet steps turn toward me. The scream is building in my chest, furious and unhinged, when I hear my name.
Anastasia?
A whisper, and then, even quieter,
Hush, Jimmy.
I let my breath out in a huff and sit up slowly. Jimmy thumps his tail against my feet.
Thomas? Where are you? I can't see anything in here.
Over here.
He shuffles slowly in my direction and stops when his shins hit the edge of my bed.
What are you doing?
I came to give you your birthday present.
He sits down beside me, and his thigh is warm against my own. I swallow, fearing my voice will waver.
How did you know?
I heard them toasting you at dinner. But I would have come to find you anyway.
Why?
To return these.
He reaches for my hand and presses something small and hard into them.
Your earrings.
How?
Semyon gambled them away the night he took them from you. We all play cards. It passes the time. But he has no skill for the game, and the man who won them can't hold his liquor.
He pauses and takes a deep breath. Then curls his hand around mine. He keeps it there as he explains.
So I made sure he had plenty of vodka, and when he passed out, I took them from his pocket.
The words come out strangled and pathetic as I start to cry again.
Thank you.
Oh, hey,
Thomas says, releasing my hand and then gripping my face gently in both of his.
There's no need for that.
He runs his thumbs over my cheeks, pushing the tears aside. I don't know which of us leans in, but it doesn't matter, because we find each other. First the tips of our noses, which brings a nervous giggle, and then our lips, which brings total silence, and awe, and heat, and amazement. And suddenly, I understand what would drive my sister out of bed in the early hours of the morning to kiss a man beneath the stairs. Because I would do this with Thomas anywhere,
at any time of day. His lips are soft and gentle, and he kisses me until he has to pull away for breath.
"Happy birthday,"
he whispers. "Do you know?" I say, opening my hand so the studs lie in my palm, "that this is the second year in a row that I've gotten these earrings for my birthday?" Thomas rests his cheek against mine, and his answer is a gentle whisper in my ear.
"I wouldn't go around wearing them. It's best if everyone thinks they were lost or stolen."
I lean away and drop the studs into my boot. "I promise I'll keep them safe." Thomas slides his thumb across my lips, but he does not kiss me again, because kisses are dangerous, and we have been foolish enough for one night.
Chapter 27. Anna. Miss Unknown. 1920. Waldorf Asylum, Berlin, June 1920. Anna has not seen the clerk since being admitted to the asylum, but he is waiting for her when she and the duck enter his office. He has brought two of the larger orderlies with him, and they stand quietly, hands folded at their waists, on either side of the file cabinet. They watch cautiously as she enters, then stops abruptly just inside the door. "What is this about?" Anna asks. "I've done nothing wrong. I've done nothing at all, actually. They barely let me out of my room." "Dr. Reischer sent for the police. It's time we learn your name," the clerk says. He sits behind the desk and runs a hand across the top of Anna's closed file. "The police don't know it either, you fool." Anna doesn't speak the words aloud, but wishes she could. The doctor comes in a few minutes later, followed by the sergeant who arrested Anna in February. If anything, he looks more incensed than he did at their first meeting. "I see she hasn't changed much," he says. Anna decides to address him directly. "I don't get out much. There's little chance to get sun on my face, if that's what you mean." "I mean," he says, placing two boxes, one large and one small, on the clerk's desk, "that you still look defiant and ungrateful. You seem to have the misguided notion that the natural response to imprisonment is gratitude. And you continue in your misguided notion that I care how you feel." He opens the smaller of the two boxes and takes out a rectangular ink pad and notebook. "I am here because the good doctor wants answers once and for all about your identity. I assured him that the moment you become too great a burden, I'd be happy to take you off his hands and place you in custody. You are lucky to have found such sympathetic doctors." The sergeant looks her up and down slowly, intentionally, as though suspicious that she has offered carnal incentive to be kept from arrest. "Let's begin with your fingerprints, shall we?" Anna doesn't move, and when the duck sets a hand on her elbow to usher her forward, she jerks it away. "No." The sergeant doesn't bother to argue or cajole. He simply waves a hand at the orderlies and says, "Take her arms." And then Anna is dragged to the desk, elbows locked and arms extended. The sergeant is quick and adept. He folds out her clenched fingers one at a time to press them against the ink, and then the paper. Anna remains stiff and uncooperative through this ordeal, but she doesn't struggle until she sees him begin to unload a camera from the large wooden box on the table.
"No photos. I don't want my photo taken. You can't. I do not give my consent."
"I can, I will, and your consent is not required. Once this photo has been developed, it will be sent to police stations and newspapers in Stuttgart, Brunswick, Hamburg, Munich, and Dresden. I'm going to make sure your face is published in every newspaper in every corner of the Weimar Republic. We'll see if we don't learn your name then, won't we?"
Anna can feel all the little threads that tether her together begin to grow taut and fray at the ends. She can feel the rebellion boil and begin to spill over into rage. What right does he have to violate her privacy like this? She has hurt no one. She has done nothing but keep her own counsel and guard her secrets closely. Her only crime was trying to end her life in a broken, desperate moment.
Had she succeeded, no one would have even cared. They would have buried her in a cemetery for indigence, outside the city, without a tombstone or marker. Yet as punishment for surviving, her secrets will spill out, one after another, like buttons from a jar. When the orderlies lift her from the desk and press her back against the wall, Anna wishes for an episode to come crashing in. She would love to lose control and thrash herself into oblivion. There's no way he could get a photo then. But her mind is oddly, infuriatingly clear. She is angry but not afraid. There is no darkness, only searing, righteous indignation. So the best she can do is scrunch up her face and twist her head to the side to obscure her face with her hair. But the officer is more cunning than she gives him credit for. The flashbulb goes off with a blinding snap, and Anna knows that whatever picture he's taken will do him no good with her face lowered and partly in shadow. But when she lifts her face to him triumphantly, he snaps another photo, this one clear, her expression almost joyful. "That will do," the officer says. "I have what I need." 3 months earlier. Waldorf Asylum, Berlin, March 30th, 1920. Later, Dr. Arschloch describes what happened to her in the exam room as an episode. Whatever he may call it, Anna thinks of it only as darkness and nightmare and memory. She thinks of it as tangible despair. It feels like cotton in her lungs and snakes on her skin. When she wakes again fully, she is alone, strapped to a bed by her wrists and ankles in a large, dim room. There are windows high on the wall, but they are only 8 inches tall and barred on the outside. It takes her a moment to remember who she is, and even longer to remember where she is. But she comforts herself with the fact that until today, she hasn't had one of these episodes in 3 months. This is progress. They came daily at first, and she's never known what to call them until now. Anna can lift her head only a few inches, but she sees that the room is filled with empty beds, each of them covered with worn quilts in different colours and patterns. She counts 7 from where she lies, but guesses there are more out of sight. When she turns her head to look, she sees that she isn't alone after all. A young woman stands to her left, staring at her. Anna flinches. "Who are you?" The girl blinks at her, curious. "Why are you here?" "I'm so sorry," she stutters in a soft, lilting voice. "I didn't mean to startle you." The girl is older than Anna, but not by much, and appears to be unbearably nervous. She sits on the bed, then stands again, smooths her skirt, wrings her hands. Anna says nothing. She simply watches, but the silence seems to rattle this strange young woman even more. She begins to chatter like a squirrel. "I am Clara. I live here." She sits down on the bed beside Anna's, pats the mattress. "Right here. I live right here." She's pretty in the way that dolls are pretty, with pale skin, a small red mouth, and eyes so large they're almost disturbing.
"Welcome. I mean, scheiße. I'm sorry you're here. No one wants to be here, but they put you in the best place. It's quiet in this ward, for the most part. The others are awful. Those poor women are crazy. The ones here just have a nervous disposition. Like me. I'm nervous. Do I make you nervous? I'm really sorry if I do. Dr. Reiche says I make people nervous. You're lucky to be in this ward."
Anna tries to sit up but can't. Her heart begins to tick a little faster.
"Will you unbind these restraints? I'd like to sit up." "Oh!" Clara presses a hand to her mouth. "They don't know you're awake. I'll go tell them." "No, no!"
She clears her throat. It's an effort not to shriek. She can't move. She feels trapped.
"Don't bring them back. Just unbuckle my wrists."
Clara is, in fact, making her nervous. Anna doesn't want anyone else to come and prod her again with questions or needles. She wants to be left alone, to plan her escape. Anna takes a shaky breath and lifts her hands, palms up, as far as she can from where they lie at her side.
"Help me."
Please. Guileless, absolutely guileless. Clara probably wouldn't survive 5 minutes outside this institution. She smiles at Anna as though they have been friends for years.
Of course.
Her fingers hover just above the restraint binding Anna's wrist. Clara's large grey eyes are bright with interest.
You look very familiar, she says.
One day earlier. Dalldorf Asylum, Berlin. March 29th, 1920. Anna refuses to give her name when asked by the admittance clerk at Dalldorf Asylum. He sits behind a metal desk that is bolted to the floor, as is his chair and the file cabinet behind him. The clerk is not amused with Anna, despite the fact that he has been warned. Dr. Winnicker told him not 2 minutes ago that she consistently balks at this, but he still takes it as a personal offence.
"I cannot admit you without a name."
He taps the folder in front of him with his pen, but Anna only crosses her arms and presses her lips together. There is a single painting on the wall behind him, a murky green abstract that matches his eyes, and she looks at it instead of at him. The painting is supposed to be a landscape, but it's mottled and juvenile. She wonders if he painted it himself. He seems like the sort of man who would celebrate feeble attempts. The clerk turns to Dr. Winnicker, who is seated beside her.
"I can't admit her without a name."
"You'll just have to figure something out then, won't you?"
"It's against policy."
"Hospitals do it all the time. She's been in my care for weeks, and I still don't know her name."
"What did you call her, then?"
"A pain in the arse."
"Funny."
"If you're looking for sympathy, you won't find it here. I've done what I can. Now it's your turn."
Dr. Winnicker lifts his fedora from where it rests on his knee and places it back on his head. He is ready to be gone from this stark institution. Anna watches Dr. Winnicker prepare to leave and feels a twinge of sadness. His kindness has been purely professional in all things, except one. Rather than handing her over to the Berlin police, he has sent her here in the hopes that she will get better. He wants her to have a chance. Even though he doesn't understand what drove her to jump from that bridge, he doesn't want her to attempt it again. That is what he said on the drive to Dalldorf this morning, his hands gripping the steering wheel and his eyes locked on the winding road ahead. Anna did not answer. She simply stared out the window and tried to loosen the restraints at her wrists without success. The clerk looks at the file again and sighs.
"What kind of diagnosis is melancholia?"
Dr. Winnicker offers an exasperated sigh.
"It is a mental illness of a depressive character, like I've written in the chart, as you can plainly see."
"But what of her sanity? This is an asylum for the mentally insane."
Dr. Winnicker appraises Anna with his keen, dark eyes. She has seen him change his mind about whether or not she is mad at least a dozen times in the last few weeks. But if he is to come to a conclusion, he does not share it with the clerk.
"As you will note in the chart, I have offered no opinion about her sanity. That is for your doctors to determine."
He rises from his chair and lays his coat across his arm.
"But do let me know if you ever learn her name. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't curious."
"If she won't declare her name, then I will give her one."
The clerk scratches two words on the front of Anna's file. "Fräulein Unbekannt. Miss Unknown."
"I don't need another examination." Anna stops abruptly in front of a door labeled Infirmary.
After Dr. Winnicker left, Anna thought she was being taken to her room. But as the clerk lifts a key ring from the loop at his waist and unlocks the door, Anna realizes she was mistaken. He holds it open and motions for her to walk through.
"All new patients are required to undergo a physical examination. It's policy, Fräulein Unbekannt."
"Do I have a choice in this?"
"Of course you do. If you choose not to cooperate, I will call the orderlies and you will be placed in restraints. The examination will happen regardless."
Anna has a sneaking suspicion that the clerk would like nothing more than to call the orderlies and to observe her exam, for administrative purposes, no doubt. He seems like the sort of man who likes to watch. She is then turned over to another physician and his attending nurse, to be subjected to another invasive exam. She can feel the muscles in her arms and legs begin to